It's Wednesday, December 9th, 2020, and this is another socially distant edition of KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly conversation on media behaviors comes to you from all over the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm Amy Simons, and I'm in the Futures Lab studio that's on the lower level of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. My colleagues, Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley, join us from elsewhere within the school. Hi, Ernest.
Hi, Amy.
And Kathy, good to be back with you today.
Hi, Amy and Ernest.
So on our program this week, a stunning survey of congressional Republicans shows that barely 10% of them believe Joe Biden won the presidential election. This presents an interesting predicament for journalists as they continue political reporting. I'm going to ask Kathy and Ernest about that. Also, some criticism of media criticism, specifically the lack of diversity among those on the media beat. And newsrooms across America, empty since the spring, stay-at-home orders. How many will stay closed forever? And while we can do some work remotely, what effect is working in isolation having on the quality of news coverage? There's a lot more that I'm hoping we get to before our time is up today, but I want to start with some changes at the top at some national news outlets this week, including the announcement that Rashida Jones is taking over at MSNBC. Ernest, it wasn't all that long ago that we welcomed Jones to our campus as the keynote speaker at the NABJ Students Chapter Unity Conference. Tell us a little bit about her. Tell the audience more about who she is and what she does.
Well, one of the things that Rashida brings to the table is experience, especially in broadcasting as a newsroom executive. A lot of what you saw in terms of the debates, especially those that were done by MSNBC and then ultimately the presidential debates, was done by her. She was the one who orchestrated many of those. And that sort of led to where we are right now in terms of her being selected for this particular position.
And your impressions of her, having been around her, seeing her work, maybe talking with her here on campus?
I think the impression that I have is that she's going to bring, not that MSNBC hasn't had stability, I think she's going to bring more of that. And you're also going to get a continuation of the diverse voices that you see on MSNBC, and that will hopefully translate into NBC News. I mean, you do see some of that, but you could begin to see more of that. I mean, you have Joy Reid, you have
Jonathan Jackson, who came over from NPR in 1A. He's a fantastic absolutely. Hire for MSNBC, by the way, about a year ago.
Right, and Jonathan Capehart started a program this past weekend with one of his Washington Post colleagues, a former Washington Post colleagues. So you're going to see more of that in her ascendancy to that position.
So, Kathy, Monica Richardson, another Black woman journalist, has been named the new executive editor at the Miami Herald. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, she is another very experienced journalist. She comes to the Miami Herald from the Atlanta Constitution, and she's had a long and many newspapers before that. So this is somebody with a great deal of experience. I also am interested, she's a single mom. She's adopted a child. So I think that's really important because it brings a different perspective to the table. It's a different view. She's going to have a different view of what kinds of stories are important. She understands the pressures of parents, particularly in these times of pandemic. So that is very important. And I also think it's important to remember that this is an appointment of an African-American executive, a Black executive at the time that the Miami Herald, we talked about this at the time, ran into some problems with its Spanish language sister publication a year or so, within the last year, and where some really racist things got through. So I think a big part of this too is reassuring readers, reassuring an audience that that the Herald is going to be sensitive to all of its readers.
So Ernest, I see you nodding your head there. Thoughts on that idea as well?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, the Miami Herald, and it's not just the Miami Herald. I mean, a lot of journalism organizations are having to deal with how do you begin to cover diverse groups who have, and we've talked about this a lot on the program, who have developed their own voices. And so how are you going to break into, as legacy news operations, how are you going to break into that and be able to deliver those voices and those authentic stories to a much larger audience? And I think both of these executives are going to have to face that. I mean, in terms of what Rashida is going to face at MSNBC and NBC as a whole, is that for the last 4 years, that network has been seen as the sort of counter Fox to Trump. And now that you have a Biden administration coming into play, how do they continue to have that sort of back and forth relationship when you don't have a polarizing figure like Trump as the foil there? So, I mean, in some ways, they could pivot toward being more progressive than what they already are and maybe go in that direction. But then that also could have a counter effect and damaging some of the brands that have built up are there because they may not be as progressive. So they're sort of going to have to deal with a lot of the issues that the Fox people faced when Obama left and Trump came in. So it's going to be a very interesting time at MSNBC and NBC as a whole. Now that we're moving into the Biden administration.
Yeah, so it's also worth noting that there was also a change at the top at Fox as well this week. The network named its first ever VP and managing editor of news. That person is Tom Lowell. He's going to oversee the network's daytime news editorial product and its news resources. He's been with the network for 17 years. Kathy, that choice leads me to believe maybe there isn't as much potential for change at Fox News as maybe we might be seeing with new leadership at MSNBC or at the Miami Herald?
You know, well, it really depends because there are two Foxes there in this hen house. There are there's the daytime Fox, which is a fairly normal news operation. I mean, it has an ideological skew, but not it's basically news. But then I think what most people think about when they think about Fox is not that. They think about the evening, the primetime shows, and then to some extent the early morning show, Fox and Friends, which are very ideological. And so it's interesting to me, Lowell's portfolio sounds like it's the news side of Fox. And the question is that going, to what extent will that predominate or will that be subordinated to the big ratings chat shows that are very ideological?
Okay. Covering the media beat can be hard. We're criticizing our colleagues and sometimes ourselves. That requires a certain level of objectivity to be able to step back and take a long, hard look at how we do our jobs before we cast stones at others. There's a piece that I saw this week, and I put it up on our Links blog, that I thought was worth us taking some time to talk about. And that's the lack of diversity among those on the media beat. Let me run through some of the names you might recognize on the national level. There's Brian Stelter at CNN, Paul Ferry and Eric Wemple, and Margaret Sullivan at the Washington Post, Ben Smith at the New York Times, Howard Kurtz at Fox News, David Zurawick at the Baltimore Sun, David Folkenflik at NPR. Ernest, the one person of color on this beat whose name quickly came to mind for me was Eric Deggans at NPR, but he's really more of a television critic than he is a media critic.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I was thinking the same thing when I kind of went through that list, and I went, well, wait a minute, where's Eric on this? And he is more of a critic that deals with entertainment, movies, that sort of thing, and not so much on the news side. That's sort of where David Folkenflik comes in for NPR in that regard. I mean, you bring up a very good point. A lot of most of them are men, most of them are white, and when you begin to really look at what the media criticism that they write about and that they report on, a lot of it is through that lens, and it's hard to see where they can really talk about the media And when I'm talking about the media, I mean with the news media, mm-hmm. the news media as a whole, when you aren't inclusive of Black and brown people, of the LGBTQ community, of those who have disabilities, of women. That was the one striking thing, is that the one name that comes up in that is Margaret Sullivan, but there are very few women. And you would think in today's age, with all the opportunities that these media operations have had to bring in people who do this kind of criticism, that they would have figured out a way to at least diversify it from a gender perspective, but they haven't done that either.
We're going to talk about that in a second. Kathy, there is also that tired old argument that there's no one of color to bring on to the beat. And I'm sorry, that's lame. And we know it's lame because one of the best out there, Richard Prince, has been running his site Journalisms for decades.
Yeah, I mean, Richard Prince is a really interesting entrepreneur. I mean, he started blogging early and created this brand, essentially, that I think is a go-to brand for not just journalists of color, but I think all of us look to Richard Prince's blog for news about the industry, but also I think for that perspective that Ernest is talking about. I think the important thing to emphasize here is that not that we're being critical of the very good media critics whose names you've cited here, but when the bias that is hardest to get rid of is the one you don't know you have. It's the stories you miss because of the blinders you were born with. And there are undoubtedly many, many stories out there about sins of commission and sins of omission by the media that we're not picking up on because it's mostly white guys writing about it, and there are just some things that they are not equipped to see. So that's why I think it's really important to have diverse newsrooms. And when I say diverse, I mean not just diverse in color and gender preference, but also we need veterans, we need people with different ideological backgrounds, because it's the diversity of viewpoints that enables us to say to each other, hey, you know, that might be a story. Have you ever thought that not doing that or not having that might be a story? And so I think that's why this is very important. And it's unfortunate, I think, that somebody like Richard Prince, who really went out there and built a reputation and was doing something when nobody else was doing it, I mean, that guy should have had a big job at one of these organizations. And the fact that he didn't just speaks volumes about the blinder issue that I'm talking about.
Well, you know, I've known Richard for over 25 years. I was one of that group of people who were signing on his blog when it was, basically.
When you were typing HTTP before a URL?
Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about AOL days. I mean, it was a long time ago. One of the things that I liked about Richard was that he, and still does this, he goes about his business in a way that is not beholden to anyone. And I think that may be one of the reasons why he hasn't gotten one of these jobs, is because he tells it like it is, and he has no problem. And I think because of his independence, he has no problem in calling out both the large media operations and the small ones. He also is very good at bringing in an international perspective that you don't see in the media criticism of a lot of the people that we're talking about. Almost every week when I read his information, you can see in there that he's also paying attention to what's happening internationally, both when you're talking about not just Latino international, but also African international. Mm-hmm. As well as European, and that's something you're not going to see that kind of criticism in a lot of what we would consider to be mainstream media criticism.
So before we cast any more stones at others, let's talk about the makeup of our little motley crew here. Longtime listeners know Rod Gillette started the show more than 20 years ago. When he retired, Mike McKean took over as host. And when Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis left in earnest, what was that, 2013, 2014, when you and I joined Mike and I talked a lot about what he wanted in a new group of permanent panelists and how he wanted to diversify it. And when Mike left, it was up to me to tap our new third person. And Ernest, we talked a lot about what we were looking for in that moment, and to make sure we had diversity of race, of age, of gender, of professional experience, and, you know, even personal interests and hobbies. And I don't want to pat myself on the back, but I've had listeners tell me it makes a difference for them too when they're watching and listening at home, that the three of us do have such varied life experiences and bring so many different things to this table.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I mean, even when one of us can't be here, we give thought to who we're going to bring in and what perspective they're going to have in terms of presenting other views that they, you know, the listeners wouldn't and viewers wouldn't normally see. So we do give a lot of thought to that, and I think it's important. I know that a lot of those who are doing media criticism around the country are really trying to pay attention to this, but it goes back to a lot of what Kathy talks about, which is when you haven't had that lived experiences, there's certain things that you're going to miss. So I think that bringing in the different voices is probably the best approach that all media criticism, those who are doing media criticism, can do.
So after that little moment of the Mutual Appreciation Association meeting,
yeah,
I want to tell you both I miss you. And while I love that we figured out a way to do this show safely using Skype with you in your offices, I miss sitting around the table. Ernest, I miss being able to look at you, give you that look, and get in. It's not about you! Or Kathy, being able to give you that nonverbal cue across the table. So you're telling me you have one more thing to add before we move on. We don't have that in this setting. Our listeners and our viewers can tell we sometimes step all over each other. We aren't able to kind of have that nonverbal communication that leads to so much of the chemistry that is between the three of us at this table, or that we have with Travis and Aaron in the control room, who can also then get a sense of what we're all doing in one place. And to some extent, there is that effect on the show, but we're not special in this, right? This is happening in newsrooms across the country, as outlets are choosing to keep their employees remote. Kathy, this isn't going to be temporary for a lot of newsrooms in this country, is it?
No, but it's been going on for a long time. I mean, this is a continuation of a trend. We've certainly seen it here in Columbia, Missouri, where the Columbia Tribune has moved out of the building it was in for a long time into much smaller quarters. I've seen it in cities across the world. Of course, most notably recently, the Chicago Tribune leaving the Tribune Tower. And when I worked for the New York Daily News, it was just a heartbreaking day when we left that building that Superman made famous, you know, with the big globe in it. So this has been happening. I will say that in some ways, it is a good thing if it saves jobs. The real estate is not what is important. In this day and age, you do not need a big building. There are fewer, we don't have giant printing presses anymore. We're tending to move more towards a digital environment, so that the size, the real estate footprint does not have to be as big. And I think in many ways, pushing journalists out onto the beat and into the communities that they're covering is a healthy thing.
That works for reporters, that works for photographers. But for people like me, who was for the longest time a newscast producer or a digital producer or a web editor, I have lost the ability, or people who do the job that I used to do have lost the ability, to stand up and shout at the person nicely across the room and get something done and taken care of quickly. And yes, Ernest, there are things that we've learned that we can do remotely, but you have to ask, like with everything that we can do, should we? Because what effects does this ultimately end up having on the quality of our coverage, our ability to do it quickly or efficiently or in a way that serves our audiences when we're all working in isolation?
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem. It takes, believe it or not, it takes longer to get things done when you're in these remote environments, because you're waiting a lot for a response from someone, either by a cell phone or by text or to get onto a Zoom meeting. It takes a lot longer to do that. I was thinking about this because I knew it was going to be a topic on the show this morning, because Monica Richardson is moving from Atlanta to Miami Meanwhile, the reporters in Miami, they're closing that newsroom. That physical newsroom is going to close. So there's not really a newsroom for her to go to because it's going to be closed. So now she's taking on the editorship of one of the major newspapers in the Southeast at a time when the reporters are all remote and they're going to remain remote for the foreseeable future. That's going to be difficult for her to try to build some sort of relationship with that group when they're not physically in the same space, while at the same time trying to put out a newspaper for a large region of Florida.
Ours is a very collaborative profession, and it does require an extraordinary amount of teamwork and trust and reliance on one another. And without having some kind of a physical presence, it's really hard to develop that trust and that belief in one another.
Well, then the one thing I will add mm-hmm. is that right now, when journalists are under attack, having the support of each other is very important, and that I think is the thing that people will miss the most. Our colleague Kat Duncan hosted a webinar early in the pandemic where she talked to photographers about how they were coping, and one of the photographers, a guy from the San Francisco Chronicle, talked about how much he missed the newsroom. And he said, I can't wait till we can have election night pizza again. I think we all kind of feel that way, too. A big part of the reason a lot of us get in the business is because of the friends we make there. And not being able to be around them is very painful.
It is.
I think another part of all this is that, and we've talked about this on the show, is the news desert, that the issue that we're dealing with right now. And this whole closing of newsrooms make me wonder whether this is going to be even more of a problem on top of what's already been happening in many of these small news operations. So say you're looking at a Miami that's closing its newsroom. Well, that could lead to further shrinking of the news that's covered in that region. So it's pulling further and further into Miami and away from some of those bedroom communities that are around. So they're going to get fewer and fewer coverage. I mean, this could really lead to less coverage of school boards in those areas and county commissioners and small city councils and that sort of thing. So that's the other fear that other problem that this could cause. I understand that it's going to help them on the financial end, which is important, but it could hurt those communities in terms of coverage.
Okay. We're going to do something that we don't often do on this program. We're going to spotlight the excellent work of a television journalist who works for the Sinclair Broadcast Group. It was through a piece in The Atlantic that I first learned of the advocacy work that Anne McCloy had been doing up in Albany to secure New York unemployment benefits. Take a listen to a news conference from a few months back in which she took on New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
Most of the people who are still waiting for checks now have issues that have to be reviewed or investigated.
You said before that some people were defrauding the unemployment system. People can't get through just to get basic questions answered to see if they qualify. They've made their full-time job trying to get through to unemployment. So they're saying it's at a point of desperation where can we do lines with social distancing where I can get my question answered, where I can find out a timeline of when I'm gonna get my money. I mean, Governor, people are literally calling our news station crying and saying that their families are starving and they have to borrow money from people. It's.
I understand. Do you want to answer on
the progress? We'll look into that option. It's a good idea. Great. We'll look into that.
After the briefing, Secretary to the Governor Melissa DeRosa reached out asking that we send over the information of anyone who has been waiting months and worked on compiling information for dozens of people all afternoon. So far, we have been hearing many of those have already gotten calls from the state.
So you talk about journalism with impact. This is a prime example. Kathy, talk a little bit more about what she's done in this community and the effect that it has had.
Well, I mean, this is local journalism. This is why we've talked a lot about how important local journalism is. This is a reporter hearing from people in her own community. and caring about what happens. It's a lot easier to reach a reporter than it is to get through the voicemail hell that
electronic phone trees that keep you from getting information. Yeah.
And so I think what this reporter did was short circuit it and go, as reporters can do, straight to the source. And this is a classic example of comforting the afflicted. I mean, she did the absolute right thing. And this is why we call the press the fourth estate. This is one of our roles, is to provide a public service. This is why the Pulitzer Prize's highest medal is for public service. It's part of what we do.
Okay. Before we go, I do want to ask you both about a survey from the Washington Post of congressional Republicans. They asked all 249 of them who won the presidential election. 26 said Biden, 2 said Trump, and 21 said it's still unclear. In an op-ed that accompanied this reporting, they suggested that every producer who books those Republicans on a cable talk show, every reporter, every host should ask that question on the air and challenge that Republican congressperson to commit to truth. Ernest, your response to that challenge?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good challenge, but the other thing that I would say is that let's talk about the issues and talk about them in terms of how are these politicians, whether they be Democrat or Republicans, plan to work with the Biden administration, and don't even bring up the current administration. In other words, let's have them talk about what the future is going to be that we all know. Let's talk about that and say, okay, you know, if they're on the Appropriations Committee, how is as a representative on the Appropriations Committee, are you going to work with the Biden administration on tackling this? I think if we start moving in that direction and away from, do you believe that he won the election or do you believe he lost the election? I think we can move past this.
Kathy?
I think Ernest is absolutely right. I think this is just a parlor game. And asking the question, who do you think won the election, is really just giving a platform to Republicans who know who won the election but are trying to pander to a base of people they want to have send money to them. So rather than do that, we're journalists, let's talk about reality and move forward.
Okay. Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I would like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. There is a lot more that you can read about each of the topics that we talked about today. That's all under the links blog on the kbia.org website. You can find Views of the News under both the programs and podcasts there. We're also available wherever you get your favorite podcast downloads. That includes iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. I'd like to thank RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's program, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. We're going to be off for the next few weeks, but look forward to being back with you again for another edition of Views of the News on January 13th. Until then, I'm Amy Simons, wishing you and yours a healthy holiday season and a very happy new year.